Good afternoon. Ooh, you suddenly got quiet. That's great. That doesn't usually happen so quickly. It's a very great privilege and pleasure to welcome all of you today. It's too nice to be inside this windowless room, but apart from that, it's a thrill to see so many of you gathered here and to open up this third annual symposium. I want to thank and welcome our distinguished speakers, Anna Everett, Esther Hargitay, and Jodine Blaze. You'll hear more from them, and someone else will tell you about them, so I'm just saying hello and thank you. I really want to take this moment to thank the people who made today's program possible behind the scenes, especially under the leadership, of course, of politics professor Leslie Hill, who will be talking to you in a moment. She had some very able assistance from members of our staff and faculty, so let me ask you now to join me in thanking Sony Reese, Eden Osuka, Hong Lin, Georgia Nigro, Helen Regan, and Heather Bumps for all they've done to make today work. Thank you. Of course, I also want to welcome, we have several trustees in the room, former trustees, members of the Cheney Society, alumni, parents, colleagues, and friends. So we have a wonderful assortment of people who are interested in this symposium. It is, as I said, the third annual symposium to consider an extraordinarily important topic for educators and indeed for citizens of the world, the intersection of diversity, broadly understood as an expansion and celebration of the identities and experiences that comprise our communities today, and technology, an unprecedented tool for knowing and doing things with information. I wanted to take some time to link what we're doing today with our first two symposia. 2 years ago, we had a very interesting discussion of demographics led by trustee Jamie Marisotis. And last year, we talked with Morris Dees, the founder and chief legal counsel of the Southern Poverty Law Center, about how to construct an educational environment to nurture the capacities we need to sustain a peaceful, multicultural nation today. I really wanted to tie this in, but I don't think I have enough time, so I'm going to let you think about the relationship between demographics, social justice, and technology in ways that I think are very interesting to tease out. Throughout these symposia, we're really following up on the mandate of the founder of Bates, Orrin Cheney, who wanted to found an institution for coming time. And we're talking about the time he imagined as coming, and we're also laying the groundwork for the next 150 years that comes after us. And nowhere, I think, is it harder and more important to see into the future than in speaking about technology and diversity. We're in the middle of a revolution, and it's a very hard place to see from. But it's a great place to think about diversity in what we do. Making progress toward the goals that started with Orrin Cheney will come, as Howard Thurman has said, not only through bringing the other into our midst. Rather, we need to locate opportunities for nurturing diversity in what we do. Technology is both tool and context today. It's what we use to do our work. So we ask ourselves, where in our designs and uses of technology do we see opportunities for building the kind of educational experiences at Bates today that enable our students to think critically and act responsibly in a diverse democracy? To introduce the speakers who've come to prompt what we do to engage this question, now it's my pleasure to introduce Leslie Hill, a longtime member of the Bates Politics Department, former chair of the Women and Gender Studies Program and division chair of interdisciplinary programs, who has done research here and in South Africa on, among other things, the dynamics of states in transition. For the last 2 years, she's been helping Bates explore more effective strategies in our transition to a more diverse and inclusive institution by working closely with me and so many of the rest of you on this campus, including the Director of Affirmative Action and Manager of Institutional Diversity Projects, the Dean of the Faculty, and the Dean of the Students, as well as so many others, to create, formulate, and develop diversity initiatives. So, Leslie, I'll turn it to you.
Welcome, everyone. Everyone here and everyone who's with us online. We will be live blogging this event today. If you have a laptop or mobile browser, go to twitter.com/BatesCollege to participate. Welcome. The Presidential Symposium on Diversity is an occasion for the Bates community to reflect on the college's present and its future. Bates has provided an outstanding education in the liberal arts and sciences, incorporating, over a period of 150 years, advances in knowledge and in strategies for engaging students in learning it. Today, we strive to prepare this and coming generations for life, leadership, and service in the context of a multicultural, rapidly changing world, and in the context of our diverse democracy. We come here today to think about forces which set the stage for learning and teaching today's students, the intersection of two of the most important differences, or perhaps supposed differences, between contemporary students and their parents' and professors' generations, that is, their understanding and experience of diversity and their uses of technology. I'm going to take just 1 minute to elaborate on that a little bit. Because the connection isn't always intuitive, and it's something that whose exploration with the other planners I've had gotten immense pleasure. Today's students have grown up in a world whose diversity has become increasingly visible as populations have become more mobile and closer to home, as barriers that were challenged in the 1960s and 70s have begun to be crossed. The Bates student population, like those of other colleges and universities, includes more people with a broader range of social identities and experiences than ever before. A great many more of our students, moreover, seek opportunities for off-campus study, where they live and work in contexts quite different from those in which they were raised. As a result, our students' approaches to learning involve different perceptions of the world and the forces that structure it. At the same time, today's learners use tools unavailable and perhaps unthinkable to earlier generations. Digital technology is, quote, native terrain, unquote, for 20th century students. Both reflecting and intentionally responding to these developments, Bates, too, is undergoing change, witnessed in parts of the new gen ed curriculum, in smart classrooms and emerging pedagogies, and in the college's recommitment to inclusiveness and diversity. Change is consistent with our mission and with our history. So we come today to think about forces which set the stage for learning and teaching today's students. Let me introduce you to our three distinguished panelists who will set the frame for our exploration of these issues. After this opening panel, they will sit and listen in breakout sessions, and at 4:15, we'll reconvene here to share with us their interpretations and reflections on what they hear in our conversations, our musings, and our collective talk. I have asked them to forgive me for making the introductions very short. I'm going to focus here on the work that they're now doing, and we'll have time in the breaks, in the before and after sessions, and after the panel this afternoon to talk a little bit more and find out a little bit more about them. But here, let me tease you a bit. Jolene Blades publications and creative work explore the overlap of digital culture, indigenous culture, and permaculture. Weaving together cultural practices, she explores tribal and networked alternatives to conventional socio-political and cultural structures and co-creates models of deep sustainability. She's an associate professor of the University of Maine New Media Department, where she co-founded Stillwater and is an organizer, a prime organizer for The Long Greenhouse. That's written as one word, but it combines some very important concepts. She thinks about longhouse, the Native American tradition of living and of social organization. As well, greenhouse is thinking about our future and environmental sustainability. It's a wonderful organization linking young people, college students, and community members through permaculture. I'm sure she'll be very excited to tell you about that. Anna Everett comes to us from California. She's a professor of film and media studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Anna Everett edited a volume for the MacArthur Foundation project on digital media and learning. That project has produced 6 volumes, one of which Anna edited, titled Learning, Race, and Ethnicity, Youth and Digital Media. Anna works in the fields of film and TV history, African American film and culture, and digital media technologies. And she's just published a book titled Digital Diaspora, A Race for Cyberspace. She's founder and managing editor of the internet newsletter Screening Noir Online and is currently organizing a conference titled Race in Digital Space 2.0. Esther Hargitay comes from just down the road. She is an associate professor of communication studies at Northwestern University, but right now is working as a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Her research focuses on the social and policy implications of information technologies, with a particular interest in how IT may contribute to or alleviate social inequalities. That's what her current book work is about. So I want to thank all of our guests for coming, for being with us today, and let's get to it. Thank you all for coming. Look forward to the discussion.
Hello? You can all hear me? Okay. I'm going to start with something that my colleague, Gisitanamuk, who's Wampanoag Native American, said to me about 2 years ago that started me rethinking my own field in new media and what it meant to work with networks. He said to me, "My people were colonized a few hundred years ago. We still remember what freedom is like. Some of you who came from Europe were colonized so long ago, you no longer remember what freedom is like." I begin with that because it took me a long time to figure out what he was talking about and to figure out what the connection between what he was saying and the work that I was doing with networks. And it seems to me that it's all about a sense of the structures in which we live, which are largely hierarchies. The hierarchies that we live in are actually colonial models. They're colonial models that came to us from Europe, from colonial empires to this country, and that we have reiterated in the structures of our governments, in the structures of our social organizations, in the structures of our economies. And if we look all around us, we find out that we are trained and that we live largely in hierarchies. And of course, a lot of that is changing. And one of the major technologies that's inaugurating this kind of change is work being done on the internet. Now, I'm not here to apologize for the internet and say this is all a utopia, because there's plenty of hierarchy online. There's plenty of discrimination online. There's plenty of old-type commerce and old-type media. So I'm not here to apologize for everything happening, but I want to talk a little bit about what the possibilities are that we might take a look at in this online space, in the internet, in the space of networks. And I want to suggest that for us, trained in hierarchies, as most of us have been, Our children are growing up in an age of networks, and they are, as some people have said, native to this different type of space. So let me give you an example that you probably remember. When Napster first came out, in the first couple of, 6 months of its use, I think it had a usage of about 63 million people. And most of those people were young people, and most of what they were doing was trading culture. They were sharing. Now, we happen to live in a culture or a society in which our cultural, inheritance or our cultural production is largely privatized and sold back to us. Our culture is intellectual property. And our children were doing something very different with it. They were taking culture and they were sharing it. And in the society we live in, sharing has been made to be illegal. But there were 63 million of them out sharing. And that's a really remarkable kind of revolution. We were talking about, I think President Hansen talked about democracy and revolution. Well, that is already a revolution. 63 million people sharing, and then the culture around them that says, thou shalt not share. So what's happened? What's happened to a culture that can't share? So I think that one of the things that we need to think about is to unlearn some of the deep structures that keep us kind of imprisoned. And many of these structures are colonial, and I think many of the ways out of these colonial mindsets might become available to us if we think about the way that networks work. So I want to talk today about the shift from pyramids to webs, from hierarchies to networks, how to unlearn these deep structures. And I want to point out three different spaces that we can talk about that might be relevant to our particular environment here and the environment I'm working in, which is also a university. I've been a teacher most of my life. So let's talk about our environment here and three areas that we might want to think about this transformation, this revolution. First, the classroom. What is our pedagogy like? In what sense is our pedagogy still based on hierarchical models? Models that even though they go online, they still are shaped like hierarchies, models like Blackboard and WebCT, which largely are top-down. Professor initiates all the content, students then listen to the content. Or if you look at the structure of academic publishing, which is still a kind of broadcast old media format, what are the network formats that we can talk about in terms of the way that we at least distribute our research or even conduct our research? And thirdly, I want to sort of very briefly mention some options for university governance. That's also a very medieval structure. The university structures are both utopian in a sense that they're perfect sites for sort of ecological living, right? You don't need a car in university. There's wonderful sort of opportunities for eco-village kind of living at universities. But there's also the old medieval inheritance of a kind of hierarchical structure, both for our learning and our social organization. So how can we overcome these very old historical structures and move into the kinds of freedoms that we may have lost along the way historically? Let's take a look at one real source of inspiration that I find all the time, which is listen to the young people. And I want to suggest something a little bit radical. There's a great buzzword in the sciences these days that the source of the best information on living sustainably is the natural world. And what we want to do is we want to do some kind of biomimicry. Let's just mimic what the biological, ecological world is telling us, because that will help us to learn about how to live harmoniously. Well, we can mimic the crickets and the grasshoppers, the snakes, the rain, the trees, all kinds of biological forms. Well, one of the most amazing biological forms right in front of us is our young people. And it is possible to think about biomimicry by watching and thinking what young people are doing and saying. So imagine a biomimicry where the bios being mimicked is the young. And I say this not just about college students. Look at the very, very young, 1, 2, 3-year-olds. Watch how they interact in the world. If you want to sort of decolonize, if you want to re-indigenize, if you want to get humans back into the land, take a child, put them in a forest or a park or whatever, and watch how they interact. They really have a great deal to teach us about how to return to sustainable ways of living. So let's think about what happens when we start following our students who are already native to this technology, who are already native to these networks. What happens when we start to listen to them? I'm going to show a number of projects that have been done through either our teaching or Stillwater, which is our research lab. This is one of them that is called Friend Finder. Our students about 3 years ago came up with something called My picture book, which was a prototype that they never basically got online, but was very much similar to Facebook and MySpace. So they were already developing this 3 years ago. They were already into the, the kind of network behaviors that other young people are involved in. This one is, these T-shirts have LED lights, and students sort of program the little computers to give preferences about who they would like to interact with or meet or what their interests or values are. And when they come across someone else with similar values, the LED lights on the T-shirts light up. So it's a kind of a face-to-face friend finder. Okay, so it's their way of networking with each other based on LED lights on a T-shirt. So, here are a couple of other projects. This is a sort of tool that we established and developed in Stillwater. It's called the Pool. This is a picture of some of us who were involved in the making of the pool project, and we actually took our photographs right by the pool. We don't actually dive into a real water source, but the pool itself is, so we have students and faculty sitting in a row. The pool interface looks like this, and it's basically a collaborative online environment that promotes diversity of forms for student work, for input, for audience, and for grading. In this particular pedagogical innovation is a system for students to generate ideas, post their ideas in a kind of online network space. Other students find similar ideas that they're interested in, collaborate with other people. They actually produce their projects. They put their projects online, and other students rate each other's projects. So we actually don't even have to grade our students. They're grading each other. So not only are they working collaboratively in sort of network models instead of competitively, they are also grading each other's work. And if you... if you've ever been in a class where you ask students to grade themselves, they're always harsher than professors could ever be. And they always elicit, I think, the best work from each other. So this is one of the types of projects that we have been involved in. This is a project that was featured in the Chronicle of Higher Education and also at Harvard Berkman Center. And we have schools all over the country who are using this project right now to do collaborative work. This is an example of how it's a little bit difficult to see because I can't really get online with the setup here, but all the projects are listed on the left-hand side, and the projects actually come up depending on how students have rated the projects as either more interesting projects. Oh, this is super. As either more interesting, this way. Wow, the top button. Yeah, the more interesting projects rise up higher, and the more often they're rated. So there's two basically scales. So the ones up here are rated most often and rated most highly. The ones down here are rated least often and then least highly. So students' projects come up in a kind of an evaluative grid that gives feedback on the different types of projects. And these are examples of students who've actually commented on other projects through different screens, and this is a description of the project itself. So the pool is actually online. If you're interested on it, you can go and take a look at what that looks like. So this is a pedagogical innovation based on networking rather than hierarchical modes of organization. How about research? We began to think that the way that academic writing works is really an old media broadcast format. One person sits alone, isolated in a cubicle, and writes and then publishes, and then 1,000 people read it. It's a one-to-many kind of hierarchy. So it turns out that a lot of people in my field, and I'm sure in your field as well, our work doesn't actually look like that, although the publishing world keeps us that way. Our work really is much more interactive, much more networked, much more social. And so we devised a particular tool for engaging the sociality of our work. The tool is also online. You can Google it and find it. It's called ThoughtMesh. And ThoughtMesh basically publishes all kinds of articles and then tags all the articles by content, and it links content from one article to another. So it creates a network of articles by theme or by topic or by subject so that you can find all the different articles, for example, that might, let me give you a sort of map of what that would look like. So these are all different articles scattered across the globe. These two articles happen to have sections on Picasso. These two happen to have sections on Cubism. And so this makes a whole mesh of all the different articles that are related. So not only do you have individual separate articles, but you have articles that are related by topic. So you have a network of information rather than single articles separate
in different parts of a library or different journals. They're all connected through their topical information. Thanks. So I can explain a little bit more how that works for anybody who's interested. In terms of governance, I'm just going to show two very quick projects. I'll just show one. One of the things that we can do in terms of governance is to think about bottom-up kinds of organization and change. I think that Anna's going to be talking a little bit more about that in her presentation, so I'll move a little bit more quickly. Here's one project that we did called You, Me, Vote, and this is bipartisan election information that was put together by on a wiki by university students. So this is not done by professors or experts, although they were encouraged to participate, but students across campus actually found information, researched it, did their own work, and put up information about the elections, what mattered to them, what the issues were, what they thought about it, what information they were finding online and off, and they basically generated their own database for what they thought about the particular elections. So this is an example of students coming up with their own version of getting involved in politics and using it for their education in sort of voting issues. I have a whole series of other student projects, but I'm going to sort of, since I only have 2 minutes left, I'm going to focus on two projects very quickly. One is a project that Stillwater senior researcher Craig Dietrich is working on and that we've been working on with him on. And this actually works with technologies and indigenous people. And he's put together an archive that actually, some of you may have heard two sort of opposite kinds of things in our culture. One is that information wants to be free on the network. Everything is free for everybody. Or there is information lockdown where it's locked down and copyrighted and no one else can have it unless you pay for it. There is something in between that cultures really desperately need. And that is places where information is safe and secure and available to the culture, and yet networked and available to different people at different levels. And this is a kind of a software that does this. So you'll see that there's three different tribes here, Kerldalen, Umatilla, and Yakama. And when people from each tribe go into this archive, they can see the data, for example, only from their tribe. Or if they're elders, they get to see the data that's tagged with elder tags. So they can actually put their information online and have it be somewhat safe, somewhat secure, and yet available to members of their community. So they can use networks to get the information around their community and yet keep it safe from a more public access. So what happens is that let me try to tie why it's important to start thinking about working with indigenous people when you're working with technology, and I think that Anna might talk about other types of diversity when working with technology, but many anthropologists suggest that the greatest loss of diversity is the loss of human indigenous cultures with their long evolutionary patterns of local adaptation. It turns out that if you map human languages, the loss of human languages, you will actually map out the loss of extinction, the loss of species, the extinction of species. So everywhere that human languages are lost, most especially traditional indigenous languages, everywhere they're lost, species die. So it's really critical for us to think about using our technologies to keep these languages alive as long as possible, because they keep actually some health and some harmony in the communities. They encode really deep cultural information. So one project that really does this locally is a project that you can hear about this afternoon when Ian Larson talks about it, is a project that one of our students did, the Passamaquoddy Living Language System. It basically uses the dictionary of Passamaquoddy, and it as a sort of back database. But what's happening is that students are taking laptops like this, MacBooks that have video cameras, into the community. They're sitting down with their elders. They're telling stories. They're recording, and they're putting this data online, and they're linking all that data to the language itself, to the Passamaquoddy language. So students who come on and look at these stories and videos are not only learning the cultural stories, but they're learning about the language, because the language is connected to the stories as they're being told. So it's a way of remembering the culture, of learning the language, of reconnecting with the language. And so this is an example of the use of technology to reconnect to culture, and to specifically this culture, to link it to place where we live right now. So the question here is, it turns out that for some of you who may be watching, that the central conflict of our time is not necessarily between Hindu, Muslim, Christian, but actually between civilized and indigenous peoples, between people of the earth who know how to live in a particular place, people who have local cultures, and what we call the civilized world. And it might be very likely that to restore the diversity of cultures might restore a diversity of species all around the world if what we know about language is working as well. I think that it would be really interesting if our technologies could take on this task of thinking about how to restore human cultures, human diversity, and how to value that in the work that we do. Thanks. And I think if I think I switch the...
First of all, I'd like to thank Leslie and the president for inviting me, and also my fellow panelists for being here. And thank you for coming and sharing this moment. My presentation is going to be in two forms. I'm going to actually read something so that I can be concise and stay within the time frame. But also, I wanted to begin with a PowerPoint presentation. So lately, I'm working on the way that young people have taken up this notion of the viral civil rights movement, and using a case study of the recent elections to show how youth have really changed the paradigm in terms of learning and technology and leading the culture. I coined the phrase Afrogeeks to sort of reframe the discourse of the digital divide, because minority and African-American youth have been poster children for the rhetoric of the digital divide, and it's been a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I want to share with you just a couple of things, and then I'll get to the formal presentation. So I wanted you to kind of take notice of the fact that whenever Obama goes anywhere these days, everybody has their cell phones, and so there is a collapse between the private and the public. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, but there we are. So one of the things that I'm interested in is the way in which the post-baby boomer group that I'm calling the where you at generation, because they're always on their phone and they're always asking where you at. But my point is that they're not only asking where you at in terms of your location, your physical location, but where you at in terms of the politics and, you know, how you are engaging with the new media and changing the culture. So what I want to do is share with you, journalist Howard Witt of the Chicago Tribune coined the phrase viral civil rights movement, and I think it's really apt. So I want you to listen to him in his own words talking about the power of the black blogosphere.
I'm Len Witt, and I'm here with Howard Witt, no relation, and I blog at thepjnet.org, and Howard works for the Chicago Tribune. He broke the Genesis story, and he talks about how important the black blogosphere was in really getting that story out to the public. So here we have a mainstream media guy talking about how he found the power of the blogosphere. So Howard, give us a little background of what happened and how it happened and the role of the Afro-American blogosphere.
I was actually largely ignorant that there even was a black blogosphere until I wrote a story last spring, in the spring of 2007, about a young girl named Shaquanda Cotton. She was a 14-year-old African-American girl in a small town called Paris, Texas, who was sentenced to up to 7 years in prison for having the crime of pushing a hall monitor at her high school. And yet this sentence stood in stark contrast to a sentence for another 14-year-old girl, another white girl, who was sentenced by the same judge to probation for having burned down her family's house. So contrast in these two situations made for what I thought was an interesting story. When I wrote that story in the Chicago Tribune, I knew it was a good story, but I didn't really expect to get too much reaction to it. And yet within a matter of a couple of days, I started to get hundreds of emails from people who had encountered that story through email, through blogs, through places far removed from the Chicago Tribune's website. And as I started to figure out where these people were encountering the story, I started to realize there was this network of blogs out there devoted to African-American issues that were actually distributing that story. The more I read of those blogs, the more I started to realize that, contrary to my assumption, I think, my kind of assumption about blogs being a bunch of kind of narcissistic people who sit in their underwear late at night and expostulate on things, I started to realize that, in fact, these blogs have, particularly in the realm of the black blogs, the Afrosphere, they have some real thoughtful things to say and some real capability of generating activism around stories. In the case of this young girl, Shaquanda Cotton, these blogs picked up that story, started petition drives demanding that she be released from prison, started letter-writing campaigns to the governor of Texas, and exactly 3 weeks after I wrote that initial story, that girl was freed from prison by Texas authorities.
In just 3 weeks?
3 weeks, 21 days. And that happened because that story was picked up by these blogs, and then in turn triggered this massive petition and letter writing campaign. A couple months later, I went to a small town in Louisiana called Gina and did a story about a situation in that town, which now many people know about that story. I was the first person to write that story. This time when I wrote that story, because I knew about the existence of these blogs, I made it a point of sending that story to a couple dozen of those blogs saying, hey, here's a story I think you might be interested in. Well, those blogs picked up that story, and in a manner that was exponentially greater than what happened with the Shaquanda Cotton story, that Gina story took off like wildfire.
Spread. Okay. So you get the idea. And also I wanted to mention that the Latino, Latina, Chicano, Chicana students, high school students, who sponsored the anti-immigration reform protests, and how they got a tremendous amount of a reaction and the spontaneous bottom-up movement, as Jolie was talking about. So I just wanted to kind of leave you with some images, and this is the Gina Six story that really broke huge as a result of the black blogosphere, MySpace, and cell phones. So I just wanted to kind of leave those images with you. And what I like to do is just stand up and kind of read the few pages that I have to kind of frame things. Okay. So viral media gone global and the where you at generation, a teachable moment. My current research project investigates the phenomenal transformation occurring in American electoral politics and new grassroots movement activism led by youth with the advent of both YouTube, the premier video sharing website, and such wildly popular online social networks as Facebook, MySpace, Bebo, Twitter, among others. What these powerful modes of interactive new media production share is the fact that they are driven by and promote a democratizing form of cultural production for the masses known as user-generated content, or UGC. UGC contrasts to traditional media cultures and industries, which normally are driven by large media corporations and conglomerates, and the brand of corporate content and messages typified by advertiser-supported broadcast and cable TV networks and their news and entertainment and mainstream print and radio journalism as well. Largely as a result of the technologically adept youth who have driven the popularity and political effectiveness of the online social networks and video sharing websites, which we will combine under the rubric of viral media, a media paradigm shift has occurred that cuts two ways, at least for our consideration of both youth and new media technologies in America's contemporary political landscape. First, viral media have enabled media consumers and political activists to become savvy media producers as well, what we call prosumers, which has made bloggers and vloggers major competitors for traditional media companies and powers. Second, traditional media industries have rapidly incorporated viral media into their hegemonic processes. So my work interrogates the ways that, for example, Howard Dean's and Barack Obama's political fortunes and misfortunes alike owe much to young people, college students especially, and the viral media juggernaut they inspired. Also, under consideration here is the YouTube effect and how UGC, such as the Obama Girl and more recently hip-hop music superstar will.i.am's Yes We Can videos on YouTube, signify interesting changes in political discourse and new youth culture and activist practices. Related to this, my work takes up the matter of how viral media are ushering in what Howard Witt of the Chicago Tribune calls the viral civil rights movement. As illustrated by the Organic Gina 6 and anti-immigration reform movement, what Jane McGonigal calls the hive mind that has developed around the fan community's embrace of the Microsoft game Halo 2 that was released in 2004. Much was made on CNN of how protesters in France were using Twitter to organize the anti-G20 protests. At issue is the question of how viral media and new digital media technologies challenge the nation's racialized body politic, both manifest and latent, particularly in this transformational presidential election cycle, and whether or not the shifts and permutations of today's digital media cultures will result in any more of a lasting change than did, say, the Roosevelt era's radio effect or the fireside chats, the Kennedy era TV effect from the Nixon-Kennedy television debate, and the Clinton era MTV effect, especially his saxophone playing appearance on the Arsenio Hall show. When Maryland Senator George Allen's 2006 re-election campaign was derailed as a result of what many attribute to his macaca moment, a racist statement, captured endlessly and circulated on YouTube, issues of race, politics, and ubiquitous media were foregrounded with powerful reverberations that continue to shape mainstream political discourse today. So my research into race and ethnicity matters in digital media technologies concerns our guarded optimism for digital media technologies as beneficial in the lives of minority youths and is not a case of positivist technological determinism, but rather is tempered by our recognition of, but not resignation to, the undeniable consequences of a persistent inequality in the deep structures of our nation and, by extension, the global information economy. At the same time, it is difficult not to be optimistic about the myriad ways minority youths today successfully appropriate digital media tools to speak truth to power and to carve out what Ian Bogos has termed in another context as a possibility space to enliven the promises of a digital democracy and to retrofit what I have been calling the digital public sphere to suit their own generational concerns and agendas. Exemplary in this regard are, number one, the 2001 use of the web by conscious hip-hop artist KRS-One to promote and organize his fourth annual Hip-Hop Appreciation Week in New York City with the theme of charity and the overarching goal of decriminalizing hip-hop's public image. Two, the massive 2006 protest against House Representative Sensenbrenner's immigration reform bill, H.R. 4437, organized largely by Latino Chicano youth, as I said before, using cell phones and the social networking site MySpace, among other media tools, to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to boycott school and work and to take their grievances to such city streets as Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Detroit, to name a few. Number three, the efforts of activist youths from the MacArthur Foundation-supported Global Kids organization, which has an enormous minority youth constituency, to preserve a dedicated teen space in the popular 3D virtual community called Second Life from the encroachments of adults. Adults are taking over their space. Okay, and of course, the precedent-setting, paradigm-shifting 2004 brigade of fearless DENIACs who used the internet and then nascent blogosphere to propel the once obscure medical doctor to the heights of U.S. political prominence, a viable candidate for the Democratic Party until the mainstream media derailed his campaign with the infamous Dean scream and its dissembling distraction. The DENIACs, as they were popularly known, both affectionately and derisively, depending on your political persuasion or situatedness, included a significant online community engaged in erecting in cyberspace what Hakeem Bey has called the temporary autonomous zone, or what Nancy Fraser would identify as a counter-public sphere, for politicizing and organizing on behalf of and in support of their chosen candidate. Howard Dean's grassroots movement, buoyed by a cadre of tech-savvy youths who Mark Prinsky has dubbed digital natives, served their candidate well and laid the blueprint for online, next-gen political campaign management that Barack Obama took to the next level and then some. Of course, the exemplars noted above represent a microcosm of the much larger and more far-reaching phenomenon of activist engagement with digital media technologies for both good and ill. This benefit-threat dialectic, or dualism, is at the crux of my concern with the digital media activism at this current moment, particularly as it challenges and reinforces troubling identity politics in America as the new millennium dawns and third-generation IT systems take shape. And whether or not we embrace or reject this new information world order from a technophilic perspective or its negating technophobic other, there is no going back to a nostalgic pre-digital state of affairs in our body politic, both local and global. As a political intrigue of campaign 2008 developed in its historic presidential contest, one thing was certain. We witnessed the role of unanticipated consequences attending the scope, breadth, and power of viral media technologies and political force of what French philosopher Pierre Lévy calls collective intelligence. At the epicenter of this new information order are today's youth, who, as Don Tapscott puts it, are growing up digital. At the same time, or pause play, those of us who might be considered digital immigrants, according to Prinsky's heuristic binarism of digital natives versus digital immigrants, we are not so willing to cede such hard-fought politically progressive ground on the basis of generational location, technological situatedness, and engagement. To state the obvious, in a post-campaign 2008 condition, everyone understands well the necessity of embracing a politics open to all comers, especially those who come with high-tech gadgets and social networks in tow. Thank you.
I'll start by saying that I'm really excited to be at Bates. So my first PhD student, Amanda Hinnant, is a Bates alum. She has since graduated. Her husband is also a Bates alum, and Amanda shares a lot of photographs on the web, so I think I've seen more Bates weddings than weddings from any other college. Okay, so I'm a sociologist by training. I do a lot of empirical work using both quantitative and qualitative methods. And I think it's nice for me to follow up these two presentations because I think we will have a dialogue here, as you'll see. So I thought I'd start with this slide that shows you all sorts of services, sites and services, some of which you may or may not recognize. But a lot of these are responsible for all the excitement that we have about technologies. And I want to say up front that I am just as excited as anybody else in this room about the potential of these technologies. But what I will be talking about are the potential limits to that we're seeing right now to people, everybody equally taking advantage of all the opportunities. So while I think it's extremely helpful to study the use of specific services and how thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of people use some of these, I think it's also very important to take a step back and to look at it from a higher level in terms of a broader level where we can see everybody and not just the users. And so what I'm interested in my work especially is rather than looking at case studies, which again I think are incredibly important, is to see who are really the people who fall into those case studies and who are the ones who don't fall into them. Okay, so Anna has referred to Prinsky's work about digital natives and digital immigrants. There's a lot of rhetoric out there about how young people are the things that are on the screen. But in fact, I challenge these assumptions. And I challenge them based on some of this empirical work I've done. I'm not going to get into detail due to time constraints in terms of what are the empirical bases, specifically the various samples and statistical methods that I use to draw the conclusions. Feel free to ask me during discussions later because I can talk about those details endlessly. But regarding these four points, based on the different data sets that I've looked at, I would say that it is indeed the case that young people have been using digital media for many years. And it is the case pretty much that they do in fact spend a lot of time with digital media. However, this idea that they engage in a lot of online activities, that assumption doesn't quite hold up necessarily as much, and certainly not universally so. And finally, this idea that young people are all universally savvy when it comes to the internet definitely does not hold up. So I want to get into some detail about these points. The main focus of my work is on what I have called skill, internet skill. You could call it literacy, you could call it ability, you could call it all sorts of things. But these are some of the components of what I think about when I think internet skill. And these are the kinds of factors that I think, and based on the data can show, actually differ considerably depending on a user. Now, in my initial work, I researched people of all ages. And not surprisingly, one of the most salient findings was that younger people were better in internet skill. Okay, not shocking. However, especially I think for those of us who teach young people, I think we know that it's not as though they're universally then super savvy with everything that has to do with technologies. And so then I became really interested in diving deeper into understanding skill differences among younger adults, precisely because then we can control for access and use and experience, and then let's see whether we can nonetheless see differences in skill. And in particular, I've been then interested in whether there is what I've called a participation gap. Others have also, Henry Jenkins at MIT has also called it participation gap. Basically, beyond skill, are people participating to a different extent? So for example, the people Anna talked about, can we see any systematic differences as to who's more likely to be taking part in the digital public sphere? Things like that. I don't think I need to spend too much time on talking about why we should care about this, but it's basically whose voices are being heard, for example. Okay, so why are we exploring this question? We know from older times that, in fact, there is participation gap. There's gap in who participates in extracurricular activities, who attends arts, et cetera. The reason, of course, is that there are all these opportunities to share. Again, I don't think I need to say too much about this here. The barriers to entry have been significantly lowered, assuming that we control for digital resources. But again, in my work, I've been controlling for digital resources precisely to see that when we go past that point, can we see any differences? And just to give you an idea, I've been looking at all sorts of participation. I define participation in very different ways. There are many, many ways you can define it. I've been interested in content creation and sharing, whether that's video, music, writing. But more recently, I've also been interested in some of these more recent advances, such as writing reviews, contributing to Wikipedia, but even simple things like voting up or down content on certain sites. And it turns out, so first of all, in my studies of skill, I've basically found that even when you control for access, and even when you control for use, there are very significant differences in skill among young adults. And there are lots of ways to measure this, and I can get into that later. But yes, there are skill differences. And in fact, these skill differences are not randomly distributed, meaning that certain types of people exhibit higher versus lower level skills. And then it turns out that these also influence what people do online. But so basically, in terms of what predicts skill, men tend to claim higher level skills. This is actually a really complicated area, so I'll leave that aside for a moment. I have a whole separate paper where self-perceived versus actual skill are related in an interesting manner. Anyway, that's not the focus of this talk, so I'll set that aside for the moment. But we also see significant differences by socioeconomic status, for example. So that's, and basically those from more privileged backgrounds have higher level skills than those who are from less privileged backgrounds. Now you could, one more point to make here is that, of course, if we're talking specifically about Bates, obviously students here are very educated, so presumably the differences would be somewhat smaller, but I have studied young adults in various settings, and even in settings such as Bates College, you still find differences among students. So just a few examples of the types of outcomes I've looked at in terms of what one could call participation, whether that's different things people do online, or whether that's actually sharing the content you've created, or visiting blogs, or as I showed before, voting content up or down, contributing to Wikipedia, all these things. Basically, almost pretty much universal is the fact that men report doing more of this, more of all of the things that I mentioned. Also, people who come from higher socioeconomic backgrounds report doing more of this, and very strong predictor of pretty much all activity. Even when the other two might not be that important, skill is consistently important. This isn't shocking in the sense that there's probably a reinforcing effect. The more you do, the better you get, the more you do, etc. But the point is that skill matters. Now, there is something nice about that, actually. We can't really intervene on some of the other factors that matter, but in fact, with skill, we can intervene, and especially in an educational setting, that's worth noting. So just a couple of implications of the findings of my work. When you walk into the classroom or when you're talking to friends, whatnot, you shouldn't assume that everybody is universally savvy. And especially, I think, because we have this rhetoric that all young people are super savvy with technology, I think there's probably a kind of context where a culture where it would be difficult for a student to raise her hand or his hand and say, oh, well, actually, I don't know what you mean when you say I should post to that blog. And so I think it's really important to be conscious of these potential differences and understandings. And then also the idea that we can incorporate all sorts of tools into the classroom, and they're very, very helpful tools for us to incorporate, but that we shouldn't incorporate them blindly, that we should do this critically, and we should have discussions with the students about them, not just about how to use them, but also what values the tools themselves bring to what's possible. I didn't really get into that, and I can get into that later. But overall, really, the idea being that we should recognize that not everybody is universally savvy and allow room for discussion so that people can get on the same level with respect to skills, so then they can equally benefit from what the internet has to offer. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. I love the fact that we have lots of different ideas, provocative ideas, ideas that don't all agree with each other, so it gives us lots to talk about in our sessions. A reminder, our breakout sessions will begin at 1:45, roughly 10 minutes. We're going to all of the breakout sessions, except for one, will be held in Pettengill. You'll find a list of them in your program and with the locations. Identity, Difference in Digital Cultures will take place in the Benjamin Mays Center. The other breakout sessions, both at 1:45 and again from 3 to 4, will take place in Pettengill Hall. Come back here at 4:15 for our closing panel. Our panelists are going to each of the breakout sessions, and they're going to listen. They're not going to talk there. They're going to listen. They're going to hear what we think about, what we ask, what we ponder about, what troubles us, what pleases us about these topics and their connections. So they will come back at 4:15 and share some of that with us. Do I have any other logistical matters to take care of right now? I think that's it. Don't forget blog, Twitter. check out who's checking us out online. All right, thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, that was great. I'm excited. There are a lot of possibilities here.